Tanya August Hansen, MLC, is at it again, spearheading legislative change. We'll hear later about planning and charities regulation, but first, her private member's bill to modernise human fertilisation, embryology and legal parentage and surrogacy arrangements in the Isle of Man. That's quite a mouthful.
It is.
And I would imagine quite a complex area to try and introduce a private member's bill to sort out. What are the issues there that you're concerned about?
So essentially there are a number of different themes that sort of run through it, and it's a modernisation to a degree, but the main sort of thrust of it is that we sort of need those changes to specific definitions of mother and father in respect of like references to husband and wife and things like that. But there are also other concerns that were highlighted by Sue Harper, who actually came into Max Radio. She did an interview not so long ago, but she was so she in 2014 she approached the then Chief Minister Alan Bell and said, like, look, there are issues with same-sex birth registration for children on the Isle of Man. She said, we don't have parity with those that heterosexual couples, and you know, particularly those with man and wife, as opposed to any other form of heterosexual relationship. Those were the ones that were legislated for, so it also created a lack of parity between those that were just partners but had children and those that were man and wife and had children. So it sort of disadvantaged a lot of people in a lot of different ways, and that's the law that we kind of still sit with at the moment. So although we're talking about human embryology fertilization, same-sex parentage, and that all sounds very complicated and very, you know, technical, and what we're trying to do is something quite simple. And I say we because there's myself and Dawn Kiddish is supporting in MLC is supporting in Legislative Council, and then there are quite a lot of supporters as well that are very much equality focused, parity focused in terms of parentage. Obviously these people are, you know, they're having children, you know, regardless of what your views may be, because I've seen an awful lot of views so far on the consultation. I won't go too far into that, but there have been some fairly disturbing things to read on their views to read on there that perhaps don't necessarily line with mine, but I'm not going to sort of pass judgment on that too much. But it, you know, they are having children, these individuals are having children, and the children deserve that parity. They deserve that parity. The parents deserve the parity. So that's where that came from. It came very much from Sue Harper, and it's something that quite informally we've been calling Lily's Law, which is her daughter's name. She, just to give you an example, and it does provide quite a good example, I think, with Sue. She had her first through IVF, and that was after, I think it was 10 attempts. Her second took a further 5 attempts at IVF. She had 5 miscarriages between that point. So her children were hard fought for, very hard fought for. Her partner went through an awful lot as well. They both went through an awful lot to get there, and their children were very much wanted, and they spent tens of thousands of pounds getting there because it's what they desperately wanted, desperately needed, and their children are desperately loved. So there are many couples that are like that, you know, and I know some quite personally as well, some friends of mine that, you know, they're wonderful with their little boy. And he goes to school with my daughter, who's 2 years old. It seems quite unfair that I would have certain rights in terms of, you know, immediate registration and that parentage, that parental responsibility, that I would get that immediately. And they don't get that because they're in a same-sex couple. That's not fair.
And I mean, I have experience of this, not from same-sex, but heterosexual couples. A lot of my friends, you know, when we got married, the wives kept their maiden names because this is, you know, it's, apart from anything else, it's not an unreasonable thing to do, but also it's quite a strong Manx tradition that wives tend, if you go back far enough, kept their names. But try registering births of children when your name is different. Oh, so you're not married then? Well, no, we are married, but it's quite a complicated thing, and we were made to feel incredibly guilty. Now, this is probably 30 years ago when this we were having this problem. Does your bill address things like this as well?
Well, yes, because it addresses fatherhood and creates a greater level of parity on registering children and in sort of strengthening that parental responsibility around fatherhood as well at the same time. There are other things as well, sort of regarding the donation of sperm, eggs, so the more complicated side of it, including circumstances around fatherhood involving same or different sex parents, assisted reproduction, artificial insemination, embryonic transfer, so all of that complicated stuff, egg donation, etc. Then there are other provisions that deal with parental rights on the death of a partner as well, you know, particularly those that are unmarried, you know, the people that aren't in civil partnerships. So it is kind of addressing some other things as well that, quite frankly, I just, you know, we really shouldn't be dealing with at this particular point in history.
Exactly. Yeah. And I suppose there'll be an awful lot of legislation that will have to be amended through this piece of legislation, will there?
Yes and no. So essentially... the main things that are to be amended, there's the Children and Young Persons Act, so that's part 9 of that, regarding fertilisation and surrogacy. And then we also have the Civil Registration Act as well. So the Chief Registrar is sort of identified through his actual, you know, interactions and his staff interactions with individuals that are coming in to register their children. He has identified amendments that would need to be made to the Civil Registration Act and is in support of this. Mm. He's also had some degree of targeted consultation. I did an awful lot of that before I actually even sent the bill out. It went off to the Department of Health and Social Care. It went off to Public Health. It went off to you know, the Chief Registrar as well. It went off to, you know, a number of different places. The courts had access to a version of it as well. You know, everybody's kind of sort of had a look at it that was is very, very much directly involved. But it's mainly those two pieces of legislation. There is a third sort of side to this that sort of links in. So as we start talking about surrogacy, we're then talking about, you know, the new provisions that are being suggested in the Houses of Parliament across the water in Westminster. So the Law Commission, in the UK Law Commission, has come up with a new bill off the back of a significant amount of consultation, public consultation across England, mainly, regarding sort of the establishment of a regulator for surrogacy, regarding the development of a new pathway plan for surrogacy, creation of a national register for surrogacy, as well as like practical matters like payment, other matters like passports and immigration. So it's about kind of like trying to formalise that on statute to make sure that both the people that, you know, all sides basically of a surrogacy arrangement are protected. Including the children that then come out of that process. So it's about that as well, whether or not we need to future proof it. So there's an element of enablement to bring that in if need be, and if that's the route that they want to take, to provide them with a means to do it through that bill.
And in relation to the bill, then obviously there's a consultation. What is it you're looking for in terms of public comment, and how? What mechanism is there available to people who want to comment on this bill?
So the bill is on the consult.gov.im website. So it's available on there. Anybody who wants to have a conversation with me in person or on the phone, I'm more than happy to talk to them. So my email address is tanya.august-hansenmlc@gov.im. I promise you, long email, but that was not my choice. It was the clerk of Tyndall's office that gave that one to me when in 2018. But if you want to contact me by email, and then I will give you my mobile number, we'll meet up at coffee shop, we can meet up at legislative buildings and have a conversation. It doesn't matter what your views are, whether, you know, I disagree with them or not. You know, I'm not going to sit there and judge you. We can have a conversation about it. Your views count. It doesn't matter what those views are, they count. Like, the outcomes of consultations need to feed into whatever it is that's being consulted about. And I strongly believe in that. So if there is a huge wave of individuals that say, no, we don't want this bill, don't be silly, then I will literally go and find something else to do with my time. That's not the experience that I've had so far. you know, the vast majority of consultation responses so far, without giving anything else away, is that that this is much needed, much wanted, and that I'm to move it forward.
2 years into this administration, hardly any legislation, hardly any bills gone through Keys and LegCo. Is this just a case of, as a member of LegCo, you've got a little bit fed up waiting? Because it is unusual for LegCo members to move private members' bills.
I've moved four so far in this administration, including capacity, you know, the Manx Care Amendment legislation, the Animal Welfare Bill, all of which I've worked on in departments.
Is it just one of those bills that, you know, this bill is the only one that's a private member's bill?
The only private member's bill. Yes, but actually no. So I work in the Department of Health and Social Care, and I work in the Department of Environment, Food and Agriculture, and I work on their legislation in both departments, and which is why I've had like the animal welfare legislation. I've been working on that since the start of this administration, so we've been working that through, and now working on secondary legislation to bring it into force and into reality, rather than, you know, all of the theory that's been going on for the last 10 years about what it should or shouldn't look like.
You know, there are eight of you in LegCo. There are 24 members of the Keys who've all recently, well, not so recent now, maybe 2 years ago, visited every home in their constituency, talked to their constituents. And none of the Keys members seem to be that bothered about changing law, which does seem a bit strange.
There's not as much interaction, I don't think, that as what would have gone in the last administration. I don't necessarily think it's a disinterest. I do think that there is a degree of interest from the House of Keys in legislation, and particularly from those that were on the backbenches in the last administration that are used to dealing with legislation, whether as it travels through the branches or if it's in Tynwald Court as secondary. I do think that there is interest. I think that that's potentially a bit of a misconception. I think that the amount of legislation that's travelled through so far is quite typical of any administration. You know, you have the first couple of years where people are figuring out, right, okay, we need to do this, we need to do that, this is how we need to prioritise things. A lot of policy stuff that's going on. Last administration, the back end of it, you know, there was a massive push for primary legislation. There was a lot of primary legislation that travelled through. The secondary then needs to be done for that. It then needs to be implemented. And I think the last 2 years, there's been a lot of implementation going on across the piece. But that takes an awful lot of work. I don't envy Jane in sort of the amount of work. Jane Paul Wilson, the Minister for Justice and Home Affairs, in actually sort of bringing all of that into fruition, because that's where all of the meat is on the bones, as it were.
Moving on, public consultation on the Town and Country Planning Act amendments, definition of development order and registered building regulations. You're keen on mouthfuls when it comes to these consultations, but actually some really interesting stuff, and generally I think really useful stuff in terms of improving the way in which planning is considered.
Yeah, I think it's overdue. I think that, you know, we talk about these things and say, oh, you know, it needs reform, it needs to be sorted out, it needs to be sorted out in these ways. Everyone seems to agree on how it needs to be sorted out. But then, you know, the actual reform work and the massive amount of effort that it takes and the huge amount of resource that it takes on an island of, you know, sort of a very small group of individuals that are sort of expert in dealing with these things and with a million other priorities. And it sort of slips to the back of the queue, really. But it is here. You know, the consultation runs until the 27th of next month. You know, it's on the consultation hub. Yeah, it's ready to go. So some, I don't know if you want me to describe what some of those changes might be.
The high level principles, what are the things that...
It needed to provide clarity around the definition of development, which will mean hopefully a better understanding for business owners or building owners on what they can and can't be done without planning approval. So that's with the planned secondary legislation as well, that will provide an opportunity to ensure very minor works can be excluded from needing approval. So basically sort of trimming down on some of the bureaucratic stuff that planning currently has to deal with to sort of have them concentrating on the things that they need to be concentrating on to speed up process.
And perhaps bizarrely, certain things which haven't been described as development previously have to be described as development so that they can be excluded from having to put in a planning application, which seems a very long-winded way of doing things, but the logic is well described in the actual consultation document.
Thanks. Just to sort of add to that, it's the removal of the requirement for concurrent planning and registered building applications as well for demolition of unregistered buildings in conservation areas, ensuring routine maintenance works to roads, watercourses don't need planning approval. Again, it's just like cutting down some of that bureaucracy.
That are already regulated. There are clear guidelines and things that have to be followed. Yeah. And the concern is that if a slight change in a plan might take place for a particular piece of work, then potentially you might have to get planning permission for something which you're inevitably going to get the permission for, but you then have to wait for two or 3 months to as you're developing a scheme. It's that kind of thing.
The attempt is kind of like an injection of common sense.
Yeah,
that's absolutely. The attempt. And the officer that's been working on all of this, I won't name him, but he is exceptional. And he has worked ever so hard in trying to bring this about. I'm quite in awe of what he's managed to achieve so far. Again, it's just introducing enabling powers for the potential introduction of fees through secondary legislation on discretionary, so pre-application advice, stuff like that. We're talking about bigger sort of developers as opposed to kind of like, smaller, smaller
developments. That's probably the only area of controversy that I could find.
I think so, yeah.
Because no one likes to pay for something that they've had for free. But effectively... For decades really, the planning department has provided excellent pre-application advice to many, many applicants. And DEFA, like every other department of government, is struggling in terms of funding.
It has to pay for itself.
I suppose the logic is, if it's development, chances are the development is going to result in the person who's applied for the permission getting an improved value to their property as a result of the work that they're going to undertake. So, if you're going to gain something, it doesn't seem wholly unreasonable to pay a little bit to get advice to make sure that you get the necessary permission.
But not for like really small developments, though. Hmm. This is very much about sort of like those really much bigger pieces that, again, kind of trying to cut down on the bureaucracy. It's going to take time. It's going to take an awful lot of resource. Right. OK, well, the planning system, essentially, it's got customers. It needs to serve the customers. Therefore, the customers that are, in the planning system, you need to have kind of money coming in, and then money going out, and then it paying for itself, and providing the customers with a very, very good service off the back of that, because you can afford to.
And
do
at
that.
This stage, this is merely enabling. There's no clarity that there is definitely going to be a charge introduced. It just allows the department at some future point to introduce a charge, and presumably there will be a full consultation before that happens.
Yeah, any regulations that come through will go out for full public consultation, yes. So alongside that, you've got sort of clarifying the scope of registrations for historic buildings to allow for these to be amended and allow for some degree of exclusion, and to make changes for the appeals process to simplify and streamline all of that.
Yeah, at the moment it's very draconian, isn't it?
Yeah.
If you register a property, I'm not sure is that the right term, but if a property is registered for its historic value, the whole property has to be described, even though some of that property might be a 1990s extension.
Yeah.
It still all has to be a part of the registration. So there's no opportunity to just say, this bit of this property, it has to be either the whole property or nothing.
Yeah. It's about sort of enabling and empowering people to sort of have a little bit more. It's their property. It's their land. To sort of give them a little bit more of their own sort of independence and empowerment to sort of do the things that they need to do with their property, particularly if it's common sense and it's not affecting anybody else negatively. So it's like it's trying to sort of like build a little bit more of that into the system, which I think is an incredibly good thing. I mean, there's the sort of improvement and future proof of the provisions for permitted development orders as well, and extending the current 5-year time limit for the implementation of comprehensive treatment areas. Probably quite a pragmatic measure, really. Sort of allows more time for consideration of options, that type of thing.
And again, the consultation's available on the consultation hub. Mm-hmm. Where we are sadly running out of time, and you wanted to very briefly mention work in relation to charities. We've probably got a couple of minutes.
Yeah. Well, just to sort of throw a third thing in there, but there is a call for evidence for the Charities Registration Regulation Act 2019. That is Legislative Council, basically. It's committee, which is the business and functioning of Legislative Council. I'm the chairperson for that committee, and all of the elected members are on that committee of that branch. And what we're doing is we're doing some post-legislative scrutiny. So that basically means the reviewing of the implementation and the impact of the law after it's come into operation, to try and evaluate whether or not it's achieved its intended outcomes. That for us is quite an essential tool that we're now making great use of. So we're looking for if there are any pieces of law that people need think may need a review, then they're free to contact members of Legislative Council or me directly as chair of the Business and Functioning of Legislative Council to talk about that, because I can put that as an item on the agenda for discussion. It's not something I can decide myself, but I can talk to LegCo about that. But the Charities Registration and Regulation came into operation in April 2020. So that replaced the Charities Registration Act 1989. Mm. I'm squinting my eyes as I do that because I'm trying to remember all of the years.
What changed was we went from a system which I think most people could reasonably describe as very, very relaxed and possibly lacking in terms of proper scrutiny, to a system that many charities will have struggled with, because it's gone from being a very, very, dare I say, amateurish approach to a very, very professional approach.
Yes.
And, presumably you've heard some concerns from charities, which is why you're taking up this particular issue.
And not just that either. Yes, I have heard concerns from charities. I'm on one myself as well. I'm a director of a charity. But it's not just that. It's actually also the fact that the Attorney General, not so long ago in the Woolah report that was released, talked about, that piece of legislation not necessarily sitting with the Attorney General's chambers and maybe sitting somewhere else in government. And then also in the department plan for the Cabinet Office, the Cabinet Office Minister said, oh, we need some post-legislative scrutiny on this piece of legislation. So I have had conversations with that minister as well about, okay, well, we're thinking about looking at this because, we've talked to charities, a couple of charities have contacted us and said, maybe this, it perhaps needs looking at. You're looking at doing the same thing where you are. So perhaps, it might be needed. Would it be useful? The answer was yes, it would be useful to go off. It's separate because it's Parliament, but it's and that's government, which sits over there. But any report that comes out of the subcommittee of the Business and Functioning of Legislative Council, which I also sit on, will then sort of feed into the Business and Functioning Committee. And then that report will then go and be laid before LegCo, before then being, if agreed, laid before Tynwald.
That was Tanya August Hansen, MLC. Is it right that same-sex families enjoy similar rights to heterosexual couples? Surely it's wrong to discriminate against people because of their personal life choices? Making the planning system easier for everyone to use must be a good thing, but would you be prepared to pay for advice? And do you think regulation of charities has become too draconian, or did it need to catch up with the 21st century? Let me know your thoughts on the programme by contacting Phil Gorn at manxradio.com and get in touch if you have any ideas for future shows. For now, though, I'm Phil Gorn, Gorn Mayo. Thanks for listening.